some of these Sunstone sessions. They're sometimes just as interesting as the sessions themselves. Our speaker is Paul Fetzer. I must announce that admission to this session, as is the case with all sessions, is by name tag, such as I have here, or ticket only. The name tag is for those that have registered for the entire symposium, and I believe the tickets are just on an individual basis, on a per-session basis. If any of you lack one or the other of these, you can just go outside in the hall and back up the hallway and register at the table. On Tuesday, March 28th, this past year, my son Richard and I attended what was billed as a facility test non-meeting type of meeting in the new conference center, where various musical and speaking tests were run. We were both very much impressed with the vastness, beauty, acoustics, and craftsmanship evident in this auditorium. Our speaker today will address some of these characteristics, as he is, or he was, as I understand it, the chief designer and supervisor of the artistic creation of much of the beautiful woodwork that exists now in the new conference center. As I mentioned, our speaker is Paul Fetzer. Paul knew he could draw by the age of 4, and he liked it. He's the one who got A's in art, built the roadshow stage sets, and the 24th of July parade floats. He studied art at the University of Utah, and after coming within 17 hours of graduation, started all over at the renowned Art Center College of Design of Pasadena, from which he graduated with honors in 1970. Paul comes from a family of artists and architects. For example, Paul's great uncle John B. Fetzer designed the major additions of wings to the Salt Lake Tabernacle organ in 1915. Casper Fetzer, Paul's grandfather, built the additions in his cabinet shop. Having grown up around the cabinet shop, Paul acquired a love for wood and learned woodworking basics doing summer work. Paul is now vice president of Fetzer's Incorporated Architectural Woodwork, where he is primarily involved in interior design and product design. His projects include the O.C. Tanner Jewelry Stores, Deseret Book, the Utah Shop, the Salt Lake Convention and Visitors Bureau at the Salt Palace, shops at Grand Teton National Park, the Huntsman Chemical corporate offices, and furniture for the Harold B. Lee Library expansion at BYU. Paul is also on the Interior Design Advisory Board at Utah State University and is a member of the Board of Directors of the Architectural Woodwork Institute. Paul is married to graphic artist Ann Thacker. They have 4 grown children and live in Holiday. Paul is also Bishop of the Holiday 29th Ward here in Salt Lake. We are happy to have Paul with us today, and we'll now turn the time over to him, after which we hope to have some time available for you to ask Paul questions or comment on what he has said. So we'll turn the balance of the time over to Paul. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Bob. I can see that I'm overdressed, and if you'll forgive me, I'll get a little more comfortable here. Let me preface my remarks by saying this is a more or less extemporaneous message that I'm going to give you today. I'm not delivering a paper. Most of what I have to say comes to you in visuals. And so unless I were to make all of this available to Sunstone in visual form, you would miss most of what I'm going to show to you today or say to you today. And so I'm just going to start by telling you that some time ago in approximately May of 98, I became aware of an impending contract that might be available to design the organ at the new conference center. As a firm, we're very interested in pursuing Zimmer, Gunsel, and Frasca architects for a possibility of doing woodwork at the conference center. It looked like the largest job that we might ever be able to get. As it was, it totaled in the millions of dollars, and we were very fortunate to be part of a great deal of Cherry woodwork in the conference center. Just about everything you see in the public areas we manufactured at Fetzer's Incorporated, the family firm where I work. So I started looking at organs and remembering the things I'd seen in the past. I thought I'd better refresh my memory. So I went over to the Salt Lake Public Library, went to the fine arts a portion of the library, and spent a couple hours finding everything I could on organs. I did pull out my Bible, and I found that there is a reference in the Bible in Genesis to a fellow who was the maker of organs. So we know that at the time of Adam, there was organ building. And now the organs at that time were quite a bit different than what we think of today as an organ. The depiction that we have from an ancient Jewish text shows a lyre-shaped wood piece, approximately 4 feet wide and maybe 4 feet high, on a rack, like a tripod rack. And this rack housed a set of pipes, and there were pipes resting almost horizontally on this rack. And then behind it, and with a series of tubes, presumably gut, and then with a sheepskin of some kind, a man in the background would blow and pump this sheepskin somewhat like a bagpipe might be played today. And so this is the very beginnings of the organ. Of course, today we know organs as being something much more grand and powered by electric blowers and elaborate machines. The wind for the organ is pumped through pipes and into wind chests and then into the pipes as the notes are played. How many of you play the organ? You have a leg up on us in understanding what happens in organs. You know, when you press an organ key down, the note plays, and it keeps playing until you release the note. That note will not play unless the wind goes to the box underneath the pipe where that note is. And to get the wind there, you have to pull a stop. Now, that's what all the buttons are on the side of the organ. You pull a stop, and that opens a wind chamber or a pipe, and the wind rushes then into this box and supplies the wind or the power for those pipes. The pipes are more or less like whistles. You blow, and there's a little aperture. It has a mouth and an upper lip, which divides the sound, and then there's a long tube, and the sound resonates in that tube. So that's just kind of a basic, and it's essential to know in terms of designing an organ. So I go to the library, I look in the books, and I'm refreshing my mind about how organs work, and I start finding some really wonderful books, and I'm learning about dipesons and verdones and trumpets and flutes and reeds and all of the different kinds of pipes that make up an organ, and I'm trying to sound as educated as I can on the subject. When I was at Art Center College of Design, I had a professor who was in charge of the library there, and he said that if a man spent a day in a library on any particular subject, he could know more about that subject than 99.9% of the populace. And I found that to be true. If a man spends some concentrated study on a particular subject in a library, he can gather more information than at least he can sound knowledgeable on the subject. So I was invited to a meeting along with members of our firm in San Francisco at Arbach and Company. And Lynn Arbach, who's a renowned stage designer, who just the previous year had completed a beautiful symphony hall in Dallas, which I had already found in design magazines and thought it was a wonderful hall. A beautiful organ, great stage, terrific orchestra. beautiful hall altogether. And I was kind of awed to be in his presence because he had done such a wonderful job. We traveled with the church architect, Lee Gray, and had met with Bob Frasca of Zimmer, Gunsel & Frasca out of Portland, and Bill Williams, who was a project manager for the building and happened to be LDS, by the way, and Andrew Feinberg, one of their head architects. And then we met with Stage Right, which are the people that make the all of the platforms and everything that comprises the podium. The purpose of the meeting was to get the organ off the ground. And I went on. When it came to my turn to speak towards the organ, about how I had spent as a young man after my mission almost a year in Germany and had taken architecture classes at the Technische Hochschule in Stuttgart. And a professor of ours who had us studying art history and architecture history would say to us, this weekend we're going to go to Milan, and in Milan we'll see such and such a church, and this will be a Gothic church, and you will note the organ is such and such, and it's in a clear story, and the windows are such and such, and they would describe the buildings, and then you will go to other places in Milan, and then we would go home and say, yes, this weekend we're going to Milan. And we would thumb our way to various parts of Southern Europe and look at the architecture, and sometimes the students didn't come back on Monday. But usually we got to see some really fantastic things. So I had accumulated this sort of backlog of useless knowledge, which I had not used my entire career as a designer. Seemed to me providential that I get an opportunity to use that knowledge, having seen hundreds of churches and being a convert of the Gothic style. I proclaimed in the meeting that if they had me design an organ, it would be a Gothic organ. Now, that upset certain of the people who were present, and then I qualified that statement by saying, people are built to a golden proportion, and the Gothic style elaborates and emphasizes that proportion, and I think that is, if we do an organ, it should be in those proportions. And that's where I left it. And at the end of the meeting, assignments were made, and they decided that I would be on the design team, and the design team would consist of Scott Bleak, who is a designer and architect with the church, Lee Gray, who is the head church architect, Jack Bethards, who is a renowned organ builder with Schoenstein and Company out of San Francisco. They number their projects in terms of hundreds. They've numbered all of the organs they've built, and our project was organ number 149. And then also on the team was Stuart Goodwin, who was an independent organ builder out of San Bernardino. And he was acting as a subcontractor to the Schoenstein Company, who didn't have a designer on staff who was free to do the design of the organ. So Scott Bleak and I were given the primary assignment to establish the criteria of design for the organ. Little did we know that there were forces already at work who had pre-designed the organ, and we were supposed to fall in lockstep and do the organ the way it had been imagined. And so we started in on that, and I will show you some of the beginnings. Trying to make this work. Is there possible to dim the house lights?
Oh.
Let me go back to that. The tabernacle organ wings, that is what Bob referred to in the middle of from the side, from here to the side, and from there to the side, are the wings of the organ. That's what my great uncle John designed, and my grandfather built. See if I can do both of this at the same time here. Electronic device in both hands. But that was an opportunity to look back in our family and see the things that had been done. Let's see. I'm going to need to have the lights dimmed here, or we're not going to be able to see the slides. Hope we're not connected to another hall here. This is my grandfather in the bowler hat. I don't know if you can see any resemblance there. I used to have a big mustache like my grandpa, but don't any longer. I was able to help Brother Kundig do this organ in the assembly building clear back in 1976, right out of, after I got out of college. And see if we can get some focus on this. It was quite an elaborate organ. This is my family at work. Richard Fetzer seated in the center. My brother Wallace with glasses next to him. Robert Fetzer, Richard's brother. My sister Carolyn and me. And this is the slide that for which I need darkness. They're coming. Well, I can go on without you actually being able to see this slide. We were given requirements that we didn't quite understand. So one of the first things we tried to do was to understand what we were supposed to do. And I met every Monday morning with Scott Bleek in his office. And as we approached our assignment, we looked at each other and said, what are we doing here designing this organ? Neither one of us had had any experience doing an instrument of this size. Both of us had had experience doing smaller things, but it was a project that was in scale way over our heads. And I looked at Scott, and he looked at me, and we said, well, I guess we had better get some help. And at that point, we decided that at every meeting that we had, we would kneel in prayer before we began our discussions on the organ. And so prayerfully, we approached our project, and on the very first occasion, there we go, that's good. That's good right there. On our first meeting, I started expounding on everything I had learned about organs. And he developed a broad smile, and then I noticed on his desk on his credenza in the back, he had a stack of library books, and that stack of library books were the same books I had gone over at the library. And when I had gone back a week later, I had been unable to check out the books because they were gone, and then I found out exactly where the books were, and we thumbed through those books and talked about the principles of organ design as we understood them and about the requirements that were going to be made of us. This particular slide here is what we were given from Zimmer, Gunstel, and Frasca, the building architects, and it was an early rendition of an organ, and it was simply to say that there would be an organ in this place. There wasn't anything here that we were supposed to copy or produce. The brethren came back a couple of weeks later after we had had some initial discussions and discovered... Yeah, I think that's fine. After we had discovered where we were supposed to be, when I say where we were supposed to be, we had to know exactly how high the organ was, where the steps were, how wide the organ was going to be, how high it could be, and how deep it could be. And that's we spent almost a full month coming to the conclusion of those conclusions. And at that time, we found out from Lee Gray, who was doing the liaison work with the brethren, that they wanted to have something in the organ which would be reminiscent of the existing organ. And so one of the first efforts that was made was to more or less replicate the pipe arrangement of the existing organ in the tabernacle. And so we went about doing an arrangement which was similar to, but not exactly the same as, the tabernacle. This is one of the early renditions. In that very first week that we were commissioned to do the organ, I had a business appointment in Washington, D.C., and on the airplane, I pulled out my sketchbook and said, where the choir is, where should the pipes be? And I started doing some early studies on the relationship of people to the organ, not knowing what the organ was going to look like. Lee Gray, the architect, sketched this practically on the back of a napkin and said, how about this? There's one that's backwards. So we established in the first few weeks where the organ was going to be. And if you can see it here, here's the front of the organ. And the back of the organ, this is a 24-foot space. The organ's 24-foot deep before it gets to a wall. And it's 73 feet wide from about the center of this pylon to the center of this pylon. And we were given the arrangement of the choir seats. And that choir had to seat 367 people, and we had better not even think about reducing it. That meant that we had 8 inches of leeway left to right, 6 inches of leeway front to back, and we had 6 inches of freeway play from the back of the organ face to the interior workings of the organ. So we were limited very severely to a rectangular space, and had to deal with it. The organ itself rests on a platform. That platform looks like this. I did this little sketch to tell the architect that we needed to have support for the heavy pipes. The organ builder was to give us weights of the pipes, and the architect was to give us a steel supporting structure underneath the organ. And the organ does sit on a platform just like this. You can drive a truck underneath the organ, literally, from the back into the hallways of the conference center. So it's on beams and columns, and all that you see in front of the organ, the rostrum, the railings, the pulpit, all flies away. When I say that, I'll give you an illustration later, but everything there is on a concrete platform, can be lifted up into the air and flown into the back of the organ into hallways where things are hoisted up and hang from the ceiling. So, because there, I don't know if you saw the birthday party or that had the whole center section of the rostrum taken away. So they had, in that area, then they had the orchestra. There is speculation that at some time they will be able to clear everything out in front and put on massive stage productions or conventions or civic events. It is. This was my first sketch. I considered it the inspired version. Never got looked at by anybody. It was summarily dismissed. And here I show some of our workings, and for some reason I've got a differing focus on this. not knowing exactly how the organ was going to come together in its whole mass, we had a couple of weeks to just play with different forms. And so we started doing some sketches on various components of the organ. And these were pipe caps that we would imagine could hold the pipes in place and provide a enclosure for the pipes. They kept looking like the tabernacle organ, even though they were contemporary shape. They kept replicating the tabernacle organ. And working on all kinds of details. This was one of Stuart Goodwin's early renditions. So somewhere along the line, we had to come to a decision. This is going to be the pipe arrangement. The flats, there are flats of pipes in between these towers. So the towers are the round arrangements of pipes. The flats are the areas in between. And a flat can consist of 9 to 16 pipes. It takes a week to manufacture one flat of 9 to 16 pipes. There are almost 8,000 pipes in the organ. So simply looking at the number of pipes that had to be made, the brethren decided we had better set in concrete the arrangements of the pipes as soon as possible so that we can start manufacturing pipes. So it was decided that the arrangement of the pipes would be set and that we would have to design around the arrangement of the pipes. Now, that sounds pretty illogical, and I think it was. And right off the bat, Stuart and I decided that if we were going to have the pipes, we wanted as many pipes on the facade as possible. And so we came up with an arrangement of pipes, and Stuart colored them in here and diagrammed them as to their speaking lengths. Now, you'll see there are some pipes that exceeded the height, the allowable height of the organ. That one pipe goes clear into the ceiling. Well, organ builders have ways to deal with these things. They bend the pipes. That is, the pipes go up and they go down and they come back up again, just like the pipe on the length of a trombone or a French horn. They're actually bent. And some of the pipes are very much shorter. The speaking lengths are shorter than the area that we had to fill, like the pipes in the center. And so we had to deal with that. You'll notice on the far right side, there is a tower of pipes, and it's completely blank. That's because all of the pipes in that right tower are non-speaking pipes. They're all dummies. They're just there to balance the looks of the organ. So here's Scott Bleek's rendition of the pipes. This is the way they were, his computer drawing of the way the pipes were to be arranged. And this is Stuart's and Scott's rendition of what the organ would have looked like. Now, you notice this big screen that's behind the organ. That never happened, of course. This organ, the way it is, there got sent to the brethren and to a theme committee. The theme committee was an outfit which consisted of several artists and designers and museum curators. James Mason of the BYU Museum for one. My friend Werner Weixler, local designer. Lance Turner, a designer from Provo. And a good friend of Elder Packer, who turned out to be a good pipeline to know what the brethren were really thinking about our designs. By the way, so what we came to realize that there were some inherent problems with the freestanding pipe designs, and as we started thinking about how the organ was going to work, we discovered that there was no way for the sound in the organ to be projected towards the people out in front. What happened was the ceiling was built in such a way that it would carry lots of mechanical devices, air conditioning, wiring, all kinds of things. And the sound from the organ was going to go upwards and into that ceiling and disappear. And so what I, let's see if I can reach over here and illustrate this for you. The pipes are in this area right here. Behind it is an expression chamber, which would also be full of pipes. And behind that is the area where the motors, which generate the wind for the organ, are created. And then we started playing with some way to express the sound forward instead of having it disappear up into this metal grill work up above. And we could tell that that was going to be nearly impossible to do with the design that we had created. So I started doing some studies as to how that sound might be projected forward. And I came up with this design instead of that screen, as to have acoustical reflectors behind which pushed the sound forward. And then we discovered that the ceiling couldn't be closed in, so I said, well, let's float some panels above the organ. And so I did this drawing that showed how the sound would go up and be reflected towards the people in front by doing some floating acoustical panels. Well, as soon as I drew this, someone in Lee Gray's office got a hold of it. And I didn't hear anything from Lee for 3 weeks. And I thought, well, I guess I'm through. Haven't really contributed that much. And every week when Scott Bleek and I would meet, we would be completely surrounded by lack of inspiration. We had reached a dead end. Lee Gray called me up and he said, I've got a great idea. My heart fell through the floor when I saw this. I thought, Berlin, Nuremberg, Busby Berkeley. I wanted elevators in the center with the choir, or escalators in the center with the choir coming down the escalators. I was aghast at the heavy preponderance of the what looked like stones up above resting on delicate organ pipes. And for a week or so, I struggled to know whether I should drop out of the design process altogether. And so I started going to my friends and asking for advice as to what they thought I should do with this organ. I was completely disheartened. And that went on for about 3 weeks. And finally, I called Jack Bethards of Schoenstein and Company. I said, Jack, we've got to get together and demand that they let us have more say in this organ. Because what they've done right now has given us a neoclassical Hitler architecture. Well, I didn't say that. Don't record that. If that comes out in print, I'll be in big trouble. But that's really what I felt. And Brother Gray said, it's too late, Paul. I've shown it to the prophet. And he likes it. And I said, Lee can't like it. He hasn't seen the alternatives yet. And so it stayed in limbo for a couple of weeks. And Jack Bethards finally wrote a letter and said, let us take another look at this. It has some virtues to it. And I called, when I got Jack's letter, I called him up and I said, are you really serious? Do you think it has some virtues to it? And he said, well, give it a chance. Let's work with it for a week. And so Lee called me and said, okay, I'm going nowhere. Jack's not going to build the organ the way it is. And we're at a standstill unless you guys save this thing. So I went to work and thought long and hard about it. This was in November of 98. And I called Stuart Goodwin up and talked to him. And he said, you know, I'm a professional French horn player. And when the sound comes out of a French horn, it's expressed by the horn flaring out. Maybe there's something we can do with these arches to make them express the sound forward and out. We're having problems with that anyway. And I went home that weekend and thought, I've got to be able to do something with this. I went to work on Saturday, and I worked all day Saturday coming up with ideas. And on Monday, I found on my desk this fax from Stuart Goodwin showing these curved surfaces out on the front of an organ. And I called him up immediately because I had just designed this, which had a what I described as a large belly of a harp or the back of a lute sound reflector underneath this arch, and then a transparent area where the sound from the organ can be expressed out the top, and the pipes below would reflect off of this big wood sound reflector, and the pipes would be freed from the columns and stand out in front, and the sound would be expressed forward by the use of a sound reflector. So everything on the organ either became sound transparent or sound reflective. So Stuart, this is the first time I felt any inspiration, because Stuart and I had simultaneously come up with the same expression, although our designs were completely different. And so I started developing a series of sound reflectors under the structure of the organ, which would allow the sound to be bounced off of these reflectors and projected out towards the congregation. Now, when you stand at one corner of the conference center and look across the conference center to the other corner, it's almost a whole block long. And so the problems of getting the sound from the organ to the people is a tremendous problem. So what happens is that the sound is mic'd out in front of the organ. That is, there's microphones out in front of the organ. The organ only has to play for those microphones. And then the sound is broadcast in real time towards the back of the hall. So if you're at the back of the hall, the sound arrives the same time it would normally. So the sound is mic'd in progression. It's computerized so that it makes it happen that way. So I thought, I had been toying with building a wooden boat, and I had a couple of catalogs, and I actually had plans for a wooden boat, and I thought to myself, this would be a good idea. We could build these sound reflectors just like a boat builder builds the hull of a boat, a wooden boat. And so I actually made this sketch because I started searching through the Northwest for boat builders who would be capable of building these structures. The biggest one is 14 feet long in the center of the organ. The smaller ones are 12 feet long. And the one in the center there, which looks kind of short, is actually 14 feet long, and the one on the right side is 12 feet long. But they're big curved structures, and I thought, I saw once on a BYU special about some people had gone to Yemen, and they were searching for the Lehi's route, and they had found some boat builders on the coast, and these boat builders were making curved wood and sewing the pieces together with sinew and cordage. And I thought boat builders would be the right people. So we went to the Northwest and found boat builders to build these structures. This was in Port Townsend, Washington, which was a wonderful experience to find these people. I was at the Northwestern School of Wooden Boat Building. Met with those people, and they had friends who were good at boat building. Our project manager got the people together. No one of them could handle the contract, but three different firms got together and built these structures. So this was after 2 weeks, this was my rendition of what the organ should look like. It was approved by the brethren, and we set about making it into hard drawings. About the time we did, it started to be questioned. Well, is that the right way to do it? Could the arches be a little different? Okay, let's make the arches thinner. Maybe the towers, the reflective devices could be different. Maybe the tower shouldn't continue all the way up. Maybe it should have towers below that continue to the ground. Maybe the reflective structure should be like half shells. Maybe the arches shouldn't be so highly pitched. Maybe they should be more decorative. Maybe it should be more contemporary looking. Maybe the arch should run through like a big rainbow. And the tower stand proud. Maybe all of the arches that should stand, or the tower should stand proud, and the arches just run in between. And then this rendition right here, all of the arches stand out, and the towers stand out. And this became the hybrid then between the tabernacle organ and the new arched organ structure which we had designed. All of that month and a half of work after November was rejected. And we decided that there needed to be something to cap off the organ and be sort of a center focal point. And this is about 15 minutes worth of draw it and reject it and draw it and reject it ideas of doing some sort of an icon. And I originally drew this thinking, well, they'll put something in here. In other words, I drew the circle. Now, it'll be a big sago lily, or it'll be a beehive, or it'll be a chaff of wheat or something. And so I drew it, and I presented it at our next meeting. And I'll come back to that. Lee Gray said, the brethren have no idea how big this organ is. Can you illustrate something to show them how big it is? So I drew a couple workmen, workmen eating his lunch up on top of the organ. I tried to get somebody to pose like that so I could take a photograph of him after the organ was completed. And he had to have so many ropes on him for safety purposes that he finally declined, just because it would take him a half hour to get in and out of his ropes. So here's the organ that I had previously drawn, and I overlaid a tissue and put a gold disc on it for no good reason at all. It's been called the golden golf ball. The golden orb. It was very beautifully lighted for the birthday party. The actual iconography of this circle within a square is a universal symbol of eternity. It is in Oriental art as well as European art, and is a symbol which has universal meaning. They may still decide to put a beehive in it. Here it is. Well, let me get it in focus. So there's the organ right now.
When was that completed?
This was completed just 2 weeks before April conference.
I thought they said they weren't going to complete it until, have everything completed until October conference.
Well, the organ does not play.
Oh.
Okay.
Minor detail.
The guts. This is the facade of the organ. There, it was the 170th conference of the church. It has 170 pipes showing. There's some, you know, something to remember there.
And they're finishing building the organ now.
And the interior of the organ is now about 3/4 complete. We're actually building some of the interior pipes. I had my daughter crawl through the interior of a big wood pipe the other day just to say that she'd done it. That's how big the pipes are that we're building that are going inside, the wood pipes.
And they'll be ready for October.
This, I think they'll be very close if they're not ready. Very close to being ready. The power of the organ. This organ will be 3 times more powerful than the tabernacle organ. That is, the same note played on this organ will be 3 times louder than the note played in the tabernacle. That, according to Jack Bethard's, the organ builder. This was one of the first shots of the organ completed, and was a. Yeah, this was the choir's first practice, by the way. And you'll notice that they're all in prayer. They all have their heads bowed. It happened to be when the shutter went down. They've been using electronic organ to date. Yes. Bob, how much time do we have? Okay. Okay, that's good. I've got plenty. If they'll stay with me, I'll keep going. So the organ came into completed state. I wanted to show you the organ complete as compared to the organ drawing. I consider the biggest triumph that I did on the entire organ was we had no idea what the ceiling was going to really look like. We didn't know with all those curves and arches up there whether the curves and arches on top of the organ were going to match or be compatible with them. It was a very good guess, and I feel very blessed to have come close to making it come off. Now, you don't see the ceiling in this shot because we blacked it out for an advertising. We used it in an advertising piece, and the ceiling's been blacked out. But the ceiling in the conference center swoops down to meet the ceiling. The ceiling's only 3 feet above the top of the organ. At our woodworking plant, we took the veneer, which we found in Pennsylvania. One log of veneer accomplished the entire organ. Now, normally a cherry log, you know, he's stitching some veneer together on this machine. Normally, a cherry log is about 3,100 feet to 4,000 or 5,000 feet at the most. We found a log of cherry that was 31,000 feet. Lee Gray saw the log in the veneer supplier's showroom, and it was covered with a drapery. And he had been looking at logs for a half hour, and Lee said, "What's under this drapery?" And the veneer supplier said, "You can't have that log. It's already been sold to some people in Japan." And Lee said, "Well, can I look at it?" And he said, "No, you can't look at it." And Lee is not to be told that you can't look at it. And he went over and threw the cover off, and he said, "That's our log." And they said, "Well, that's impossible. You know, we've already sold this log, and it's already been committed." And he said, "Well, it's been committed, but it hasn't been sold, right?" He said, "Yes, they've already flown over from Japan to look at this log." And Lee said, "When the organ is done and it's on TV and millions of people are looking at it, they'll see this log. If you sell it to the people in Japan, it'll go to an office somewhere and be lost forever." That got them a little bit, got to their pride, and they said, "Okay, maybe we'll consider that." And so they allowed us to buy that log. That log was 31,000 square feet. Came from Susquehanna Valley, I guess you could say, not too far from historical events in the church. It's not a very old log. It was purported to be planted, of course. The seed dropped at the time of Joseph Smith and all of that, you know, that you read on the internet. All of those urban legends are incorrect. It's a fairly young tree. But a very, very significant piece of wood. And I'll show you some shots of that. So in our plant, we formed all of the pieces to the organ. Now, every piece was drawn individually. So the unit, the entire organ was unitized, so into individual pieces. And these pieces were manufactured individually and never put together in the shop. So each one was sized on the computer, manufactured in the shop to the right size, and never put together in the shop. First time we put them together was at the site as the organ went up. So curved pieces, they're making trim for the boat structures. This is a remarkable piece of woodwork. This is the volutes on the front rail. You'll notice that they have alabaster lights in the center of them. This does not belong to the organ, but it's such a wonderful piece of woodwork. I wanted to show it to you. Now you can see the veneer on this round volute. This is the same veneer that comes that belongs to the organ. These are the bases to the organ. All of this is structure that goes into the organ. Now you can see the veneer as it's put together. This is the top of one of the towers upside down as the painter's spraying it. And that's the veneer. You see it's very, very, this is a one in a million log. It's a very rare piece of veneer. Now, when we went to Port Townsend, Washington, we met with Ed Louchard, a boat builder, and he said, if you build me the structure in Salt Lake City and send it to me, I'll assemble it, and then I'll have a structure to which I can apply the wood so it'll be exactly the right size. And so we sent him the structure, he put it together, and this is looking at it from the back, and he's got a little sign there that says, Louchard Yacht Restoration, Port Townsend, Washington, and that ran a little bit. And Dennis's name is on there. So my counselor in the bishopric said, my sister, my wife's sister is in Port Townsend. She's getting ready to sail to the South Pacific, and the boy she's sailing with is working on the organ, so he can't go. And I said, well, maybe that's good that she doesn't go sailing with boys out into the South Pacific. And he said, well, she hasn't been in the church for 10 years, and so that's not going to help her much. And a few weeks ago, I met her. She sailed to the South Pacific with three Frenchmen, and on Easter Sunday, she decided she ought to go to church for the first time in 10 years. And she walked into the church in Takaroa, 1892, an LDS church, and sat down to a wonderful Polynesian lady, and she said, after church you come home with me to dinner. And she did, and after dinner she said, you stay with me this week. And she did, and after a week her friend sailed away, and she said, you stay with me for a few months. And she did, and she became converted to the church. So Salt Lake to Port Townsend to Takaroa to get converted. So there's these boat structures. Big, beautiful pieces, all put together, never assembled in the shop. The individual pieces are 1.5 inches thick, solid cherry, each piece tapered and bent. So there's the crown molding on top of the organ. See how high that is? 3 feet high. Huge pieces. On the job site, we had to build a steel structure to support the wood. You can see the steel there, and our people are putting attachments, and the steel people are working side by side to make attachments so that the organ be lifted and pieces can be lifted into place and assembled. There's one of the boat structures being lifted top of the organ. There it is, the center boat structure lifted up, being put into position. So here's the organ with the, you can see the steel stretcher work and the steel towers behind. I don't know if you can notice, but the top part of the organ is installed, the bottom part of the organ is installed, and there's nothing in between. So the pieces were fit in between from the top to the bottom. All the scaffolding in place. So a week later, a week after this photograph, we're putting pipes in. And the pipes were shipped from California and from three other places in the United States. And the pipes are being assembled. They are ready to be put into place. On the right, upper right-hand side of that photograph, you'll see that there's a what's called a tow board, which is a board that's carved out. There's circular holes carved out to receive those pointed parts of the pipe, the foot of the pipe. And down below, to the right side of the gentleman with his arm behind his back, there is a hole that goes down 30 feet. That shows you where the real floor is. The floor is 30 feet below that point. This is the largest pipe on the front of the facade. It's 18 inches in diameter.
Well, I guess needless to say, nobody that has worked on this, either on the keyboard work itself or any of these pipes or the structure, has ever done anything quite like this before. Is that safe to say?
I'll give you an illustration of that point. The pipe builder called us up yesterday and said, you know, the pipe that you're building, there haven't been pipes like that built in 100 years. Literally. He knows of no one who's built a pipe that size in 100 years. And we're building these big wood pipes, and he said, we don't know exactly how they're going to work, but we tried the one that you sent us. We sent him a model pipe a couple of weeks ago, and we had to make some changes, and he told us some further changes to make to the pipes. He didn't even understand why they were built the way they were. He told us to build them out of instructions that he received that are over 100 years old. Yeah. So those big pipes on the front of the organ are actually pieced together in about 12-foot pieces. Let's see how they're...
Everybody seems to know what they're doing and that the final result will be beautiful music that will have the...
I can't wait to hear the organ. I think it's going to be spectacular. So there are these boards called scallop boards, and there's a man standing on the top scallop board. You can see his white hat. A man standing on the middle scallop board, and a man standing on the lower scallop board, and then another 12 feet below that is the tow board. So each man fits the pipe to the scallop board, which has a big, thick layer of felt so that it rests against it and is not the resonance is not disturbed. And then the pipe has a bolt on the back of it at that point and is fastened so it doesn't fall forward. Here again, this is the biggest pipe of the organ being installed. It's below audible range.
It's below what?
It's below audible range.
Is that right?
Yes, you can't hear it. They told us that when they tested the pipe that it rippled the skin on the back of their hands. But they couldn't hear the pipe. And that's a good question. And I asked the same thing of the organ builder, and he said that the reason they put that pipe in is that when you play the pipe that's one octave above it, it doubles its amplification. It amplifies it double. Yes, it makes that note real strong. Yeah, and without that, the octave below, it doesn't do that. So. There was an engineer on this that was a separate guy. But we had to do... He told us what the problems were. He didn't give us any solutions. We had to solve the acoustical problems as far as the roof in the organ and expressing the sound forward.
What, did you learn that in woodworking school? Or?
Well, thanks to Stuart Goodwin, who provided us with some good information and some inspiration, we were able to accomplish a lot of this. And I have to say that in retrospect... Lee Gray's insistence that we have this arch structure turned out to be pure genius, because it was the only way that we could capture the sound inside of the organ and express it forward without having floating or flying panels above it. And so it turned out to be a real stroke of genius on his part to insist that we have this structure, even though that we've changed it a lot and made it more expressive. It was the right thing to do.
And the Hitler effect has been modified.
Well, it's gone. You know, it's Now it's a very, it looks like a musical instrument now instead of a piece of architecture.
And even though it's not your original Gothic reception, it's close to it, you say?
If you go through the organ and measure all of the proportions, you'll see that they're all Gothic proportions.
So
yes.
I got
my wish after all. Yeah. I wanted to clean the surfaces of the organ and couldn't do it very well with long handles. And finally, I called a young man in our stake named Aaron Chammy, who is at the current time the world champion speed climber. He won the world championship from a famous Frenchman. He's one of these gym rats that can hang from one finger. And I said, Aaron, can you come and clean the organ for us? And he said, you know, I'm going to Lake Powell this weekend with my family. And he suggested two more of his climbing friends, and they came down, two young men who were going on missions the next week. And they got in their climbing gear and rappelled off the ceiling and cleaned all the surfaces in the organ while the choir was practicing. And no one from the choir even looked up to see them. And I do have a few digital photographs of that. I haven't reduced them to slides yet. Let's see, I can get the lights back up now. Yes, that'd be fine. I promised I'd say something about the pulpit. See, I don't have any way to display this, but I wonder if you'd hold that up for me a little bit, Bob. About 2 months before the opening of the conference center, we said there's just three things left to do. One is the area right around the pulpit and these volutes out on the ends, whether they have lights in them or not. And we probably ought to get a decision from the church as to what we're going to do. And they said, well, why don't you go ahead and make a suggestion to us, and then if we like it, we'll follow it. And so I spent a weekend designing the pulpit, and this was the drawing that I created that showed how I thought the pulpit ought to be. The pulpit recesses completely under the floor. It's on a lift, and the lift lowers down, and the pulpit disappears into the floor. And next to it, there's a security gate, so if anything ever happened, a security man could come up through the floor. That's just about 10 feet away, and that's an interesting, it's not really a serious security thing right now, but the pulpit has some interesting features. And I don't know if you know it now, but the existing pulpit has air conditioning, and this pulpit also has air conditioning. There are some ducts that come up through the pulpit, and in the dashboard of the pulpit, the air comes forward and blows on the person who's there. There is approximately 10,000 foot candles of light at the pulpit. Now that will melt plastic. It really is very warm there. And President Monson, I know he likes to have it turned up full. And I don't. Sometimes at conference, especially if you have high definition TV, you can see his hair, kind of the little hair on his head, kind of blowing a little bit. He really likes it going fast. There are also two speakers in the dashboard of the pulpit. And those speakers help the person who's speaking hear himself. There is so much vast nothingness out in front, there's nothing to reflect the sound back, so he can't tell how loud he's speaking. So he has speakers there so he can gauge his voice. There is also a teleprompter cut in the surface of the pulpit so that he can read the teleprompter if he wants to. And, of course, there's teleprompters out in front so that he can read the messages that are going out in front. There's a range of motion so that a person in a wheelchair can speak at the pulpit. And President Dunn what, is he 6'5 or 6'6, can also stand at the pulpit and speak. So it does have quite a range, about 18 inches of motion in the pulpit itself, up and down. It's also bulletproof, which is interesting.
What's bulletproof?
The pulpit is bulletproof. Yes. Yes, it has Kevlar cladding inside. As does the all of the rostrum and railings behind him. Now you've heard about the famous walnut log. The walnut log from which the pulpit was made was from the tree that grew in President Hinckley's yard. I checked with Larry Sagers when I got my first piece of it. As a matter of fact, I've got it here. I've got a little bag of pulpit things here. We got a branch of President Hinckley's tree, and it has little holes along the bark. And I could see that it had borers in it. And so when I saw Larry Sagers, who I know, I said, "Larry, how come this walnut tree has little borers in it?" And he said, "Every walnut tree in the valley will be dead in a couple of years. There's an infestation of borers that are attacking the walnut trees, and only the young ones will survive." So every older walnut tree, and I've had dozens of calls since we did the pulpit job, And people say, "My walnut tree just died. Had another call this week. What should I do with it?" And I tell them to go to George Hessenthaler in Providence, Utah, and have it dried and make a nice piece of furniture, which would be a legacy to them. So here's a branch out of President Hinckley's tree. You can see what it looks like. That's what we made it look like. So you put a little stain on it, fix it up, it starts to look like something. Once you pass that around, you can see what it really looks like. So I'm the only other person who has a piece of the branch. President Hinckley has the other piece of wood that goes with that. Only two slabs of wood came out of that branch. And this is our only sample that we have left of the wood. Brad Banks brought over two logs in the back of his pickup truck and said, "Do you think this will be enough to build a pulpit?" And I said, "Yes, I think it will be. Why don't you go dry it?" And he found a person in Syracuse or Salem, Utah. And these people did a wonderful job at slicing these logs up into slabs and kiln drying them. In this area, wood has to be dried to about 6% moisture content for us to work with it before so that it doesn't warp and twist. And we got these pieces of wood back 3 months later from Brad Banks, who had them dried, so beautifully dried, and selected out the best boards, and then tried to make the pulpit out of them. Well, we only had about half as much wood as we needed. There were too many knots, and it was really pretty ugly. Don't tell President Hinckley that. No, he knows that we had our problems. We had to take the individual boards and split them in half, so we had to 3/4-inch thick board, which we cut in half, laid those two boards open, and then planed them down to 1/4-inch thick, and then used them like veneer. So we glued those thin pieces to a thicker substrate, and that's how we made the pulpit. Now, there were some... a substrate of chipboard, of particle board. So there's particle board underneath, but the 1/4-inch is all his genuine walnut. Everything you see there is the genuine walnut tree from President Hinckley's tree. Now, there were some special things that we did. The dashboard, what I call the dashboard, and this top piece of the pulpit right there are made out of a very special burl that occurred on the tree. And that wood there, we had about 6 pieces of it, and we booked those pieces open and made them very thin, and they have a very beautiful swirl to them, so it looks like the dashboard of your Rolls Royce. Well, not quite. I don't think President Hinckley would approve of me saying that. When we got to this point right here, we called Kathleen Hinckley, President Hinckley's daughter-in-law, and who happened to be a friend of my cousin's. And she had expressed to my cousin that she wanted to come down and see the pulpit. And I talked to her and to Kathleen, and Kathleen said, by the way, would it be okay if I brought my father-in-law to see the pulpit? I said, no, that probably wouldn't work. And she said, well, why is that? And I said, well, we've been given instructions not to let anybody see the pulpit that isn't authorized by legacy constructors. And she said, well, I think I can get clearance. And so Brother Staley, who's President Hinckley's secretary, was in touch with us and arranged for a time for President Hinckley to come down and visit. And it was a delightful visit. President Hinckley was so cordial to everyone he met. And everyone who worked on the project, on the pulpit, was there. Now you can see the pulpit's in kind of a rough stage right there. I don't know, the wood's a little rough. I've got the dashboard in my hand. I'm showing it to President Hinckley. The man on the right side, on President Hinckley's left, is Bill Proctor, who was the mill man and milled out all the pieces for the pulpit. And the man to his...
Should I turn the mic down?
No, I think that's okay. They can't really tell who they are anyway. And the man to his side is Cole Dalton, the man who did all of the technical drawings for the pulpit. And Cole Dalton had a drawing in his hand, and he said, President Hinckley, would you sign this drawing? We need approval on what we've done. And President Hinckley laughed at that and signed his drawing. So Cole actually has in his house framed his detailed drawing with President Hinckley's approval signature, you know, a little slot on the side that says approved by. And he has the prophet's signature right in the approved by spot. So that you can tell, by the way, I'm standing and where the Bill's standing on the side there, that the pulpit's up on blocks. And President Hinckley said, I want to feel how this is, you know. Can you let me stand behind the pulpit? And so we hurried and made a little box for him to stand on, and I went to help him up, and he just jumped right up on there. And he held on to it, and he said, this feels pretty good. Then he said, now, brothers and sisters, I'd like to counsel you today. And that got a lot of laughs from those of us who were standing around. But we had considerable conversation. I showed him the beehives. Now, this is one of the beehives that goes around the side of the pulpit. Well, that's what he said. That doesn't look much like a beehive. Carrie Nielsen, the church architect who's in charge of the project up there, said, but President, there aren't any beehives in the whole building. We're using the Millennial Star. And he showed him this. This is what's going in the pulpit. And President Hinckley said, well, I think we should have beehives in the pulpit. He said, okay, President, but there aren't any beehives in the rest of the building. And he said, well, this will be a good place to start. And so I was commissioned to design a beehive to go around the pulpit. And if you'll pass this around, this is a piece of President Hinckley's tree. And we actually took Bill Proctor, the mill man, raises bees. He has beehives. And he brought in a piece of honeycomb starter. This is a piece of plastic with a little bit of beeswax on it, and this is what they get to the bees to start building their little combs on. And I put ink on one side, we scan it into the computer, and then we put it in our computer and cut out the piece of wood. So you'll see this piece of wood over here that's actual honeycomb-sized little cells. And that's what the background is for the beehive. So there's cherry on the beehive, which you see here, and the background is President Hinckley's walnut in that honeycomb pattern. And you can't even see it on camera. I was so disappointed. There's another thing here I'll show you that you can't see on camera, and that is a beautiful Solomon seal carving that is in the four corners of the icon that's on the top of the organ. Solomon seal is a worldwide plant, and it was the signet ring of Solomon who rolled it into wax, and that was his seal. So they called this plant Solomon seal, and this is the pattern in the corners of the icon that's on top of the organ, which you also can't see. So it was a delight to have President Hinckley in our plant. He said, now why don't you get the workmen that have worked on this pulpit and get them together and let's get a picture of me and Sister Hinckley with the people that actually worked on the organ, on the pulpit. And so there wasn't anybody in the shop that didn't want to be in the picture, even though about half of them worked on the on the pulpit, and then they all ran together, and he welcomed them all, and we had our picture taken together. There is a fellow kneeling on the lower left. He had a copy of President Hinckley's book, and he got his signature. So he has an autographed copy of his book. He's had it at work for a month and a half, hoping President Hinckley was going to show up to see the pulpit. It was a little dusty, but he got the signature that he was after. He's right, Sister Hinckley, right there, and the pulpit's buried in there somewhere. Anyway, it was a fun occasion. So certain myths: the tree isn't 300 and some odd years old; it's 36 years old. It wasn't a real wonderful tree, but you can make a beautiful thing with wood. And he did we made a beautiful pulpit for him out of that tree. And I think it's indicative of President Hinckley's feeling towards things. He likes to conserve, and he loves the sentimental aspect. There are little pieces of his tree that are being made into jewelry boxes. And I know his daughter has a couple little pieces of tree that she's had carved and going to put on a bookcase in her home. And President Hinckley's grandsons are pretty good at woodworking, and they've made a few things out of the tree. So every little scrap of the tree is being used. We were told that we were not to use any of the tree for anything but the pulpit. And so when we were through with the pulpit, we gathered up all of the scraps of the project, everything from little tiny pieces. We had a barrel full of scraps. And a couple of our guys got some sawdust and scooped it into baggies and put it into baggies and put it in the barrel to show that we had returned everything. We had a barrel full of scraps that were scraps left over from the project. So the only pieces of walnut that we have left are these little pieces, which are from the beehives, and this little branch from President Hinckley. Do you have questions that I can answer for you that I might not have covered? Yes.
Maybe just a comment and then a
thank you. There really are some amazing things. I don't know if you know about it, but if most people who listen to an organ, it just sounds, everything sounds like an organ, you know, and they don't notice the various eccentricities of the sound that comes out of an organ. You've heard the bells that they play around Christmas time. They're like little chimes. They have reeds. The reed pipes have a different mouth structure, and they're actually made out of metal, and they mimic reed instruments like oboes and clarinets and flutes. There are flutes too, which mimic the sound of a flute. The trumpets really do sound like trumpets, and so if as you're listening to organ music, try to pick out the various pipes and what they are trying to mimic, and you can pick them out, and they're very definite. If you hear the noontime little concerts that they put on over at the tabernacle, they try to go into some of those extremes, and and play a wide range of pipes that, that are in the organ. Now, yes?
Would you finish? Could I ask a question?
Go ahead.
The group's just finished, but I just want to make sure you didn't forget that I have a question.
No, go ahead and finish.
To my way of thinking of building the casework for an organ, but
do you want to repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is how many different groups and minds do we have to satisfy in coming up with the let's see how I could say that a casework design which solved and all the problems. There were a lot of people who expressed opinions. The opinion that counted most in my mind was Jack Bethard's of Schoenstein. He's the one that hangs his hat on the organ and is the one that has to claim the organ as his, because most of what the organ is the way it sounds. It is, after all, a musical instrument. And the musical quality of the instrument is what counts the most. And so he has to make sure that the case builder, first of all, builds something that expresses the sound the way it should and looks the way it should, so that it looks like it is a musical instrument and is doing its job. So as a designer, I tried to please Jack first. The second most important thing, of course, is to do something which is compatible with the hall. And it's a huge hall and one that demands a significant presence of an organ behind this big choir and this big rostrum area. And so we had to go, the aesthetic concerns were, of course, to relate to the building and the architecture without being architecture. In other words, it had to look like a musical instrument and yet be compatible with and satisfy the demands of the architecture. So that was probably the second most important thing that we did. And then thirdly, I think it was to bring a fresh approach to an organ that had never been done before. We wanted to do something that was unique. I think if we had had organ builders that knew what they were doing, we would not have achieved that. And I, you know, I say that tongue in cheek, but I really mean it. I think we, the design team on the organ, was just naive enough not to know that we couldn't do what we were doing, and so we leaned on the Lord for help, and I think in the end. We got a beautiful result. Yes?
I was wondering if everything...
We got done on time. I think that's the thing I can say. Sure, there were slowdowns. Sure, there were things that stood in our way. The steel structure was a little slower than we anticipated, but it was beautifully completed in the end. We had everything done and waiting and ready to install when it should be. Jack Bethard's had the pipes ready to go in and were beautifully finished and completed on time. And I'd say it was wonderfully completed. Yes.
Does the organ meet an earthquake standard?
Indeed, the organ does meet an earthquake standard. And it meets the standards of the building, which are very stringent. Everything about the organ was run past seismic engineering. The towers which support the organ are probably 10 times stronger than they need to be. They're wonderfully designed, and in fact, there's some bracing behind the organ pipes which show that I went up and blanked out myself with paint on a Saturday morning after arguing with the structural engineer that he couldn't have them there because they would be visible, but he said they had to be because of the seismic requirements. So... yeah, I was acutely aware of the seismic sufficiency of the steel structure. Yeah. Yes.
What was the organ?
We started mimicking the tabernacle organ, and the theme committee said it looks too much like the tabernacle organ.
I mean the tonal resources.
Oh, the tonal resources. The organ is designed to be every bit as versatile as the tabernacle organ. The tabernacle organ has a lot of pipes that are duplications or maybe redundancies. This is the bare minimum. The wind pressure, I don't know if that's the right way to express that. It has a great range, but it's more economical in terms of its construction.
How much of it is
electronic? None of it. It's all wind powered. Yes.
But the wind is run by.
There's a room that's about 12 by 15 with all the blowers in the back, and that provides there's a 4 or 5 squirrel cage blowers in the back, and they go through a series of baffles, so no sound comes out to the front. Yes. We figured that everything was possible. From the very first day that we start designing it, we figured that at some point everything was going to be flown out in front of the organ, and the organ would be sitting there on the concrete slab all by itself. In other words, it wouldn't be lowered, but there would be nothing there but the organ. And so we plan for that eventuality, and we have designs that are as yet uncompleted for the area below the organ. So the stage is a wonderful thing. It's the stage designers have done a fabulous job. There's huge modules that can be moved out of the way on air bladders. There's what they call air casters, and there are compressors inside of these modules that pressurize these air bladders, so that these thousands of pounds of structures that underneath can be moved out by a couple of people. They actually float on a molecule of air as they are pushed out. I see the time that that conference center will be used for things that we can't imagine right now. No. No, it has a very confined... There's a very confined space for the expression chambers, and that thing will be absolutely jammed full of pipes in a month. Absolutely jammed full of pipes. The 30-foot-long pipes that we're doing right now will be mounted horizontally on the wall in back of the existing pipes. Yes?
I guess the Tabernacle Choir broadcast will originate from...
It will continue to be originating
from the
Tabernacle.
Sunday,
yes, that's right. By the way, off the record, I can tell you where to sit. The best seats aren't on the floor. The sound, which comes from the organ and the choir, is best heard when it's assisted by the loudspeakers and the microphones. I prefer the front of the first balcony myself. That gets you closer to there, so you can hear some real-time choir and organ sound, but you get the assist from the loudspeakers, and really on any of the balconies are terrific. They're very good. The worst is about 100 rows back. 50 to 100 rows back.